Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Lawrence Wechsler was a staff writer for The New Yorker for over 20 years, and now as director of the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU, he's still one of those reporters whose area of interest cannot be boxed into a beat. But one of his main interests has always been human rights, and that's reflected in a new collection of his work, Uncanny Valley, Adventures in the Narrative. From Rwanda to Chile to the founding of the International Criminal Court, Wechsler has traveled the globe having, yes, adventures in narrative by reporting and telling stories about human rights. Wren joins me now in the studio. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you again, Brian.
Wren Wechsler, you were telling me as you came in about Occupy Wall Street and the similarities to reporting you did in 1980 and 81 in Poland on the Solidarity Movement there. That's the Solidarity Movement which produced the trade union, which was not controlled by the Communist Party there at the time. What's the connection for you to Occupy?
One of the founders of Solidarity, Ada Michnik, was in town the other day, and we went down there to Occupy Wall Street. And his comment at that point was, this is exactly the way we were in Poland in 1976, which was 4 years before Solidarity. People have figured out to say no, which is a huge moment. They don't know, quite yet know what they want to say yes to, but they are saying no. And a lot of my thinking about human rights comes out of those Polish reports that I did very way, way back.
Did you challenge Adam about even a basic comparison between speech and politics in communist Poland in the Cold War and whatever people may be protesting at Zuccotti Park in this country today?
He interestingly could relate to what was going on. I mean, it's interesting in terms of Poland because they took the shock therapy, the neoliberal stuff, right after Solidarity won later on, and have had misgivings, and I think he has had misgivings about it, and the polarization of wealth is one of the problems. In the book, there's
Poland's in the news today for its own government debt being downgraded.
This is a worldwide phenomenon, and it is the aftermath. There's a joke that in 1989, capitalism defeated communism, and in 2008 it defeated democracy. But the thing is that in the book I had this – the first piece in the human rights section is a collaboration I did with Richard Avedon. And there were 10 human rights monitors that he photographed and that I talked about it for a while. And in the essay that I wrote, I talked about the phrase, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are so forth and so on.
It's a fascinating essay. You break down that sentence.
Well, that sentence it has everything to do with Occupy Wall Street. In other words,
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Okay.
We all know these in this country when we're 5 years old.
But listen to that. It's a really weird sentence because you would think logically it would say it is self-evident that blah, blah, blah. But in fact, it's not self-evident. And in fact, all of history teaches us the opposite, that men are basically men. All tyrants know.
It's up to us. We hold these truths.
Well, this is the point. All tyrants know that men are basically meat on sticks. And so does capitalism. Capitalism lays off people left and right because they're just meat on sticks. The market, the tyranny of the market, we could say, behaves the same way. And people are not created equal in the market. They just aren't. Except the key words in that sentence exactly are not self-evident or truths or so forth. The key word in that sentence is we hold. They aren't self-evident. They are fugitive. These are truths that are fugitive. They are evanescent at best until people together hold them and pledge their lives, their sacred honor, and so forth to it. And when that happens, something really amazing and magical, and I would use the word uncanny in the context of the title of my book, Uncanny Valley, happens, which is suddenly that truth becomes real. It is not real. It is a complete fantasy. It is a complete fabrication. But it becomes completely real. It begins to glow, and it begins to melt tyrannies. And I think, we can talk about that in the context of you could talk about the right not to be tortured, but you could also talk about the right to live a decent life, the right not to live completely at the whim of the market, the right not to live in a country where 1% has doubled in its, the 1% has doubled their wealth in the last 30 years at the expense of everybody else. In some completely abstract way, there's no right not to have that happen, except if we hold these truths to be self-evident. And the minute that happens, history begins to move. And that's what Adam was talking about, that in 1976 it began to happen, and by 1980 it had erupted. And Adam, looking at Occupy Wall Street, at that little tiny thing, was saying this is exactly how it happened, and we brought down the whole Soviet empire within a few years.
So you're saying Occupy can be seen in a human rights context, even though we may think of that term as applying more to disappearances and political torture.
Well, I mean, or I'd rephrase that. It's not, I mean, human rights, there's a whole discussion whether human rights includes economic rights. I don't even want to get into that. But I would say that we hold these truths can apply to both. And that if people don't approve of a country in which somebody who has 250 million has this incredible need to have 300 million, and that that's at the expense of the education system in your local neighborhood, if you don't approve of that, the only way to make that self-evidently not just is if you hold it together with others, and that's what they're trying to do.
So to the other extreme end of the spectrum of the human rights world, last month we had Zimbabwean activist Fry Maguwu on the program talk about his activism around blood diamonds.
Right.
He was in
town. That was a great show.
To be honored by Human Rights Watch with the Alison DeForge Award for Extraordinary Activism. And I mention this because Alison DeForge is featured prominently in one of your essays in the book about a Human Rights Watch monitor in Rwanda. Do you want to talk a little bit about who she was?
Oh, she was an amazing person. In that first piece I was talking about with Avedon, where we photographed 10 monitors, that was in December 1993. That's when, where I wrote We Hold These Truths and so forth. One of those monitors was a woman named Monique Mujawamariya, who was a monitor from Rwanda. This is December 1993. And they told the story of how, in her case, for example, she had taken Alison DeForge and some of the other Human Rights Watch people through Rwanda. And just before they were leaving, she had been taken aside by the head torturer of the regime at the airport, and he had whispered something to her. And Alison DeForge called Monique afterwards and said, "What did he say?" And Monique told Alison, "He said that if you include my name, the torturer's name, in the report, I'm going to come back and kill you, Monique." And they said, "Well, what should we do?" She said, "Well, of course, include it." To which I say, you know, such preposterous acts of courage shouldn't work, but they do. If they do have this kind of magic quality. But in any case, the incredible thing is, 4 months later, she was swallowed up in Rwanda, and Alison DeForge in New York was desperately trying to save her friend Monique. And it's an incredible adventure story how they, in fact, pull it off. And then the way that the code of that story is that you might remember that terrible, crazy crash of that plane in Buffalo. You know, that rainy night, it turned out to be the pilots were too sleepy or something. And she was on that plane. Alison DeForge had done some of the most heroic work in human rights in the world. And ended up dying on a stupid, rainy, sleepy flight, you know, into Buffalo.
Randomness.
Yeah.
That was the Colgan air crash, I think,
a
couple of years ago.
Exactly, yeah.
You wrote a piece which was posted this month to TomDispatch.com and now also in the LA Times about having to bribe some Ugandan police officers to give you back your iPhone after taking a picture with it.
Right.
And for some reason, this gets you thinking about corruption in the United States,
right.
And you can't decide which is worse.
Well, what it was—it was a crazy situation. I was driving over the Karuma Bridge in Uganda, and the Nile River was just surging. It was an unbelievable thing to look at, and I was just had my iPhone out. I was taking pictures, and on the other side of the bridge, these three soldiers come up and say, and they just confiscate my thing, and they say, "You're not allowed to take pictures of the bridge." I said, "I wasn't taking pictures of the bridge. I was taking pictures of the river," but they had it, and that was it. And you know, I'm one of those people whose my entire life is on the iPhone, and this is really tense. And it ends up that my driver and the police get together, and you know, 20 minutes later, $20 later, I get my iPhone back. But we got into a conversation, and it turned out with my driver and I, and this happens to him all the time, but he understands it because at that lower level, police officers and so forth are so ill paid, and in fact, it's even worse than that. The people above them skim part of their salaries. that it's just part of their job that they can do this. And he asked, doesn't that happen in the United States? And I initially said, no, we don't have that problem in the United States. And then I start to think about it, that a lot of the corruption in Uganda, in these third world countries, is at the bottom. It's desperation, you know. But in fact, in the United States, the corruption is all at the top. It takes the form of congressmen becoming lobbyists and of campaign finance and people writing in the tax laws, things to get the millions of dollars. And it's not out of desperation. It's out of greed. And you know, I say I can't tell which is worse, but I can tell which is worse. And the people that occupy Wall Street can tell which is worse, and you can tell which is worse.
We're almost out of time with Lawrence Wechsler, his new collection of essays called Uncanny Valley, Adventures in Narrative. And let's end by talking about narrative for a minute. I wonder how that applies to human rights. You know, Nick Kristof, New York Times columnist, talked about this challenge himself in finding a person or a character to hook people's interest to the story when it's really hard to get Americans' minds around what happens in Rwanda or Uganda or Kosovo or wherever else that may be considered remote to our lives.
Well, it's interesting, by the way. The book is called Adventures in the Narrative.
The Narrative.
And we had a fight with our publisher about that. And the point of it is
– over the word the?
Over the word the, because I want to talk about the narrative in the sense that we are all in a narrative together. And people either – in this particular instance, and this goes back to Poland, they think of themselves as objects or as subjects of the narrative. When you're the object, you're just, you know, being beaten up, your house is underwater, there's mortgage, you've been laid off and so forth. But what happens occasionally in history is that people who've been thought of themselves as objects in other people's narratives suddenly become the subjects of their own narrative. And I think those are the moments that are incredibly exciting. And by the way, they make for great stories. And I think the thing that if you had talked to me a year ago about politics in the United States, I would have said it was hopeless, partly because we couldn't figure out what the story was. Suddenly, the great thing that Occupy Wall Street has allowed people to suddenly realize is what the story is, to get a focus on that, and suddenly become subjects of that story. And that is an extremely exciting moment.
The book, Uncanny Valley Adventures in the Narrative. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the renowned evolutionary biologist and atheist, Richard Dawkins, on the magic of reality. Stay with us.